Coming up on Boston Public Radio, the governor joins us for his monthly visit. We'll talk with Deval Patrick about a surprising late endorsement this morning of a Democrat in the contested race for attorney general, his role in the market basket deal, very good news on one part of the jobs front, and what he, his wife, and the Obamas had for dinner on the Vineyard.
Continuing our interviews with candidates before Tuesday's primary, Charlie Baker joins us in the studio, and the Globe's Alex Beam on the wonders of Norwegians, dumpster diving at John Updike's house, and whether Don Berwick, the gubernatorial candidate adored by progressives, is the Adlai Stevenson of 2014. Then we'll ask you, do you vote for the candidate whose views you support, even if he is doomed to lose? That's all up next on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Eastern Brownie, I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Hey there, Marjorie.
Hello, Jim.
So here with us in Studio 3 for his monthly visit for Ask the Governor is the Governor, Deval Patrick. He's taking our questions and yours at 877-301-8970. You can also email the Governor at bpr@wgbh.org, and you can watch this streaming hour live at wgbhnews.org. Good to see you, Governor.
Over Jim's balding pate.
Thank you.
The part,
no, I really
that's the part of
that.
The production, I think, is not to be missed.
That's right.
Nice to see you both.
Thank you very much. Great to see you, too.
I hope your summer's
Governor
been
Patrick.
Good.
It's been great. I took advice in a restaurant you gave me up in the Berkshires, and it was terrific.
Oh, you went out with your daughter, right?
I did. Good. Cafe. I forget
Cafe Adam?
That's right.
Yeah, great.
It's excellent.
Good stuff.
So kind of some breaking news we should start with this morning. You have endorsed in the hot attorney general's race between Maura Healey and Warren Tolman. You have endorsed Warren Tolman this morning. I was surprised.
Have.
Yeah, why did you do that?
I know, because I'm supposed to stay out of contested Democratic primaries.
Yes.
And I tried to. I think both of these candidates are so good and have so much to contribute in terms of experience and vision and skills and character. Warren and I have known for 20 years, and he played a very, very special role. I mean, he's been a friend and a close one for a long time, but he played a very special role in my own reelection campaign in 2010, both before the cameras and behind the cameras, and mostly behind the cameras. And it's something I feel very connected to him about, and he and his team were relentless. Yes, today I endorsed him, and I'm excited. I think he would be, in addition to bringing what we get from and should expect, I think, from any attorney general in terms of effective enforcement of the law, I think he'd be an activist AG in the sense of using the influence of the office to improve the lives of Massachusetts people and small businesses.
You ever endorsed in a contested primary where there's not an incumbent Democrat?
I don't know about the qualifier. I endorsed Elizabeth Warren when she ran. I should remember
when Marisa DeFranco was challenged here before the convention. But is that it?
Yeah, I have to do my homework.
Would you like to endorse anybody else on air here today?
No.
Why not though? Actually, I mean, since you praise Maura Healey as well, who many people think is a late version of you, civil rights lawyer, battling the establishment.
Well, and her work on the DOMA issue in particular is something that is deeply meaningful and impressive to me. I think, like I said, I think the people of Massachusetts will be well served by either of these Democratic candidates. In Warren's case, as I say, it's personal.
So are you contemplating doing it in the governor's race or
no? Nope.
Who are you voting for in the governor's race?
I'll tell you after I voted.
Okay. You will?
I might.
Oh, well, we'll call you on Tuesday, Governor.
Let me qualify that. I might tell you.
Yeah, you have a prediction for Tuesday?
No.
Speaking of Tuesday,
I know what the polls all say, but, you know, polls don't vote.
Speaking of polls, not polls in terms of who's the front runner of the three Democrats, Bill Galvin, the Secretary of State, is pretty good at predictions, has suggested that he thinks turnout could be 20% or lower, which I think is pathetic.
Yeah.
And then some. Why, assuming he's right, and he's right more often than not, why do you think that is? Why is the interest or level of participation as pitiful as it appears to be?
Well, I hope he's wrong. He's often right. I hope he's wrong. But whether he's right or wrong is up to us. You know, you and me, and all the people who are listening, and all their friends. you've heard me say before, we get the government we deserve. And if we want engaged and enlightened and effective government, we got to get out and vote. We have to assure that the candidates, by virtue of knowing they have to be accountable for us to us in the at voting time, are themselves reaching out and listening to us. And I hope that's what people will do. I'm going this afternoon out to Worcester for a Get Out the Vote event with Congressman McGovern and some of the members of the Worcester legislative delegation for precisely that reason. And if other candidates want that kind of help and I can provide it, then I'm happy to do so.
Maura Healey just called and said she'd like that kind of help. 877-301-8970 is the number if you want to get through to the governor. Now's a pretty good time to do it because the lines fill up very rapidly.
You know, I have a theory that one of the reasons people don't vote like they used to is that they feel very disconnected, don't get what Governor Patrick matters to me or whoever the next governor is going to be or the attorney general, and they just don't get the connection.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think?
I think there's something to that. I think we worked really, really hard in both of my campaigns at the grassroots, and it was both a political and a philosophical motivation. It was a political motivation because that was the only way that a newcomer was going to break into this very tight political establishment here. And it was a philosophical motivation precisely around the point you make, that people, they aren't shown the respect of your showing up and asking them. And not just asking them, but to asking them what they think. What do they need? Why does it matter to them? And that they have all the power they need to make all the change they want. And then the big challenge, of course, is once you're in and you're doing the job, is staying connected at the grassroots, because there's a whole bubble that forms around elected officials, especially I think statewide elected officials, where there's so much incoming and you're constantly dealing with the day-to-day. You kind of got to get out and let people hear directly through you and not through the various filters that there are.
You know, there's a lot of debates going on right now for the gubernatorial candidates. Do you watch them?
You know, I haven't.
Really?
What are you doing at 6:30?
I know that was a setup for Jim's to plug Jim's debate tonight. But I was telling you before we went on the air that my wife's 91-and-a-half-year-old dad has moved in with us now, is in declining health, and my oldest daughter, our oldest daughter, and our grandson are with us now as well, and she's helping take care of him, and they've been with us for much of the summer. So we have four generations living in our house, and it's which is a terrific thing, but it's a little chaotic. So when I am able to be home at night, I need to do my share to help out.
You know, Governor, we got an email this morning that said we always save the good news in the state for the last 30 seconds of the show, and I think there's some truth to that. And very briefly, if you can, in light of the fact that jobs has been the central theme in this gubernatorial campaign, as it is in almost all, there's some actually very good news on something you've made a priority of, this life science thing. Want to give us a couple of seconds on what's been happening of late?
Sure. Well, as you know, I think the listeners do, we are at a 25-year high in overall employment in the Commonwealth. We've come out of recession faster and stronger than most other states, and growing very, very strong compared to the national growth rate. Obviously, there is more to do. Obviously, there is more to do, particularly in spreading those results out to gateway cities around the Commonwealth. But life sciences in particular has contributed to that growth. And it's not just in the PhD level. It's throughout the range of employment. We continue to have new companies put down roots here. We have. I think it's GE Medical.
GE Healthcare
is moving their life sciences headquarters from New Jersey up to Massachusetts. There'll be, I think the prediction is something like 400 or 500 jobs associated with that. I'm getting a hint. Maybe it's 200 jobs. 200 jobs at the outset and growing. We have a couple of other announcements I hope we're going to be able to make soon. That are probably more like the number I first mentioned, but it's happening. It's exciting.
Governor, let's take some calls. Our number is 877-301, 8970. I forgot the four numbers at the end. Let me try that again. 877-301-8970. The governor's with us and you until 1 o'clock. Governor.
Okay. Tyler is calling from Greenfield. Tyler, are you there?
Hey, Tyler.
Hey, how's it going?
All right.
I just more or less had a comment. Wanted to thank you so much for coming out to the Pioneer Valley. I'm from Greenfield.
Excellent.
You came out for the Amtrak thing, and
yeah.
I'm really excited for it. It's going to start in a few months because a couple weeks ago, I just drove down to Washington, D.C., stuck in traffic, took like 13 hours. Looking forward to taking the train next time. So thanks for all you did for that.
Tyler, thank you. For listeners who may not know, is this appropriate for just explain what
sure,
Tyler
absolutely.
Was talking
yes,
about?
Please.
The Vermonter line is coming back to the Pioneer Valley, which is to say the Amtrak is going to run up from Hartford through Springfield, Amherst, Northampton, Greenfield, and then on up to Vermont. This is part of a right-of-way we purchased some while ago with the help of Recovery Act money, and we've been refurbishing, and the service is supposed to start before the end of this year, which is really, really great. The other great thing, I should say, beyond the Amtrak, being able to hop on and go to New York, and it's important because economically the orientation in Western Massachusetts is more north-south than
yep.
it is east-west. So that's an important connector. But once the line is up and running and Amtrak is doing their thing on an inner-city basis, the opportunity to think about these new DMU cars, which are the cars they're rapid transit cars, basically that you can use on a rail line on an Amtrak type line to do commuting service between and among the towns in the Pioneer Valley is a huge economic opportunity. We won't get to deliver on that before we finish, but I hope the next administration will help.
Let's go back to the phones, Governor Patrick.
Let's see. Jamie is calling from Sharon. Jamie, you there?
Hi, Jamie.
Yes. Hello.
How are you?
Hello?
Hi.
Hello.
Thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
Governor Patrick, on this show last month, you advised the people of Massachusetts to be patient around the implementation of the medical cannabis law.
Yeah.
It's been 20 months that medical cannabis has been the law. No patients have been registered. There is no safe or legal distribution. Back in April, patients went to the State House and asked for you to act, intervene. We haven't had a direct response. Now, DPH, and even last month when you advised patients, DPH's plan is to be in violation of the law that 53% of the voters enacted when you leave office. How do you merit patients when you have ignored the will of the voters?
Well, Jamie, thank you for the question. It's not correct that we've ignored the will of the voters, but I don't think that the voters voted for having licenses granted to applicants who lie on their license or on their application or don't comply with the law. And that has been your question is actually at the crux of the challenge here. There are certain numbers of people, many of them, who say, hurry up, we want to have medical marijuana as quickly as possible and as closely as possible. And there are others, many of them the same people, other voices, who say do it with care because we don't want to have the wrong sorts of folks or folks who are unsavory or unqualified being involved. And trying to strike that balance takes time. I don't think we're going to be out of compliance before we leave office, but I know people are frustrated.
Will you have dispensaries?
I know. Excuse me. I think we're going to do our very best, we're not going to have state-sponsored facilities in places where there isn't a qualified provider who has come forward. Some of that we have to turn to the
caregiving, and the department has not permitted it, except for a few dealers who were posing as caregivers.
Well, we're not going to be able to create a facility where there is not a qualified applicant who comes from that community. And I wish that in every community there was a qualified applicant, but we've seen from media reports, and I've seen from the briefings I've gotten that we have not gotten qualified applicants from every caregiver.
Okay, Jamie, thank you for the call. Governor, two quick things on this. I'm sorry I can't think of the name of the woman who runs this process in DPH, but when I interviewed her recently, she said, despite some of the problems, the vetting problems, that the first dispensaries would be open in November. Are we still on that timetable?
I think, you know, she'd be closer to that than I, but I think...
Karen Van Unen, I'm sorry.
Karen,
yes.
Yeah. I think, I know they're working real hard to get it done, but to get it done right.
And secondly, I've asked this before, but all three Democrats running to succeed you were asked last night at a consortium debate if they thought the medical marijuana selection process should start all over again. And if my recollection is correct, all three said yes. Do you disagree with that?
That would not make Jamie happy.
but would that, you disagree with that, correct?
No, I don't think it's necessary. I think it was important. You know, this is in that category, I would say, of no good deed goes unpunished. Meaning that in the effort to be very transparent as the team was working through the vetting process, they took the step of saying to the public, here are the preliminary cuts. And that started a whole firestorm because the background checks hadn't been finished, and they were criticized as if they hadn't complete. They hadn't done background checks, so I think that I'd love it if it were faster, but I think people wanted to be careful above all.
Thank you.
I wanted to read some of our emails and Facebook postings as well. This is from John, Governor Patrick. He wants to know.
His name is John, Governor Patrick?
Yes, it is, actually. It's amazing.
I know. I think
he's named after you.
He was so inspired after your election. Why did the governor break his silence in the market basket issue, knowing his – I'm not sure this is true, but knowing that his wife, Diane Patrick, is a manager at the law firm that was representing Arthur S., wasn't that a conflict of interest?
No. It's interesting. Somebody wrote me something like that.
We've gotten a lot of emails about this.
Which is the first time I knew that her firm had any involvement. And when I asked about it, she didn't know. And what we learned and what we subsequently made public is that her firm, not she, but her firm, represented a committee of the board. They didn't represent the company. They represented a committee. I don't even know what committee it was, but that didn't have anything to do with my involvement or non-involvement in Market Basket. I will say this. Do you mind if I go on?
No, you've got
a lot
of credit.
No, we want to talk about it.
Yeah, I mean it's really such a fascinating story, and I as interesting as the public part of it is, the private part of it is even more so. It has all these layers and nuances and all these really good people on all sides of it trying to get to the right result. There weren't clear heroes and villains, except I would say the people who work for Market Basket who just showed an extraordinary and beautiful kind of loyalty to Arthur T.
Last time you were here, maybe 5 weeks ago, you quite strongly said something like, I don't think it's appropriate to get involved in a private dispute, mm-hmm. in a private company, intra-family, that sort of thing. Why? Two things. One, why'd you change your mind? And what exactly was your role once you decided to get involved?
So I haven't changed my mind. I don't think it's appropriate for a governor to get into the question of who should be the CEO of a private company. I just don't. What the employees precipitated was an economic impact on a quite broad spread, not just in this state but in New Hampshire as well. 10,000, I think it is, of the 25,000 people who work for Market Basket work in New Hampshire, and you better believe that's of concern to me. Not knowing whether there was a role that I could play, I wrote to the parties. I want to say the end of July or early August, I think it was, and saying, you know, look, from after then, what was it, 3-4 weeks, the impact was beginning to be seen. It was a great worry. We didn't know what was going to happen with the employees at that point, because though the company had up to then continued to pay everybody who was working, they weren't going to be able to sustain that forever, and that was going to have an impact on individual citizens of the Commonwealth and of New Hampshire. and I offered whatever help they thought I could they thought I could offer. And I will tell you, I got calls almost immediately from Arthur T, from Arthur S, and from the chairman of the independent chairman of the board, and we talked through some of the issues and about whether there was anything we might be able to do. We spent a lot of time on the phone, and then after you know, some backing and forthing around where the independent of that phone call, that didn't seem to be where nobody seemed to be getting anywhere. You know, there were reports about offers being made and not accepted and all that stuff. We finally said, let's get everybody in a room and out of the public. So we got together in Springfield. I invited Governor Hassan down from New Hampshire.
What kind of room?
It's just that the governor has an office in Springfield.
Okay, the governor's office.
Yeah. One Sunday evening. And we spent 4 or 5 hours together. And there were a lot of people there. Originally, it was supposed to be a representative of each. This isn't really the right word, but each faction, and a lawyer if they wanted, and there ended up being a lot of people in the room after all.
Were the two Arthurs amongst the?
Yeah,
the group?
They were there.
They were there together in the same room.
They were there, and they're great. Yeah, they're family. They have a relationship. It's not as fraught as it sometimes made out to be. There were some very genuine common concerns about the company being strong and sustainable and doing right by the people who work for it. Common concerns among all the parties.
How many people?
And there were some
like
deep
20?
And genuine, I don't know, maybe a dozen people.
A dozen people, okay. Mm-hmm.
There were some deep and genuine differences about what that meant and what kinds of responsibilities were owed to the various shareholders in the deal. And I think one of the things that came from that conversation, the ones we had, all of us, and then the kind of separate ones we had, was an understanding that you couldn't ultimately decouple the question of ownership and getting a deal done from the question of Arthur T. and his management team coming back in to stabilize the company. So it became really at that point, in my view, important for them to close on a deal. And I had said, I remember saying to one of their lawyers that when I was general counsel of a Fortune 50 company, we merged with another Fortune 50 company in about 10 days' time.
Was that Coke or Texaco?
It was Texaco.
Uh-huh.
And that, you know, I realize this is a big company, but that was a lot bigger one with a whole other set of complexities. And they ought to set themselves a deadline for figuring out whether they could get to a deal or not. So it wasn't just kind of, you know, drifting along. And they did that. And they missed it by a couple of deadlines by a day or two. But they got there, and I think they're proud, and they should be proud of what they were able to accomplish.
You know, there were two executives that were brought in, the gentleman from Radio Shack that had run Radio Shack, and the woman, I think her name was
Gooch and Thornton.
Yes, that had been involved in supermarkets.
Yeah, I've never met them.
That's what I was going to ask you, if they were there, if you had any sense of them, because they have not really appeared in public. Did you have food during this 4 or 5 hour meeting?
No.
No.
Well, I take that back. We had some nuts and a cookie. We didn't expect it was going to go 4 or 5 hours, but
would this deal have happened without you and Governor Hassan?
I think they would have gotten there. I really do. I think
Chairman of the Board said you guys made a huge difference in pushing through the idea.
Well, I think they would have gotten there, but I think that they were having trouble understanding the connection between Arthur T. and his management team running the company and the ownership. And the acquisition, I guess I would say, and that meeting on that Sunday, I think, had a lot to do with everybody getting on that same page, and that of course accelerated the work to getting a deal.
Let's go back to the calls, Governor Patrick.
Let's see. Michael is calling from Arlington. Michael, you there?
Hello, Michael.
Hi.
Hi, Michael.
First, I want to make a short, unprepared statement following the market basket thing. Governor, I think you should have our film unit really promote Hollywood on doing a movie on the whole market basket thing, which is unheard of. I mean, I'm 76. I went to the business school. I've been in business from Hong Kong to Cambridge, and I've never heard of anything like that.
What part of it, Michael? What part of it, Michael, was the most surprising to you?
25,000 people, and besides the top managers who got canned. But think of that, giving up for not going to work. I mean, some of them went to work and kept the stores open, but that was good, actually. But for that many people to stay out, for whom? Wait a minute. Did you say an employee with a grievance? An employee that was wrong?
Well, and the solidarity.
No, 25,000 people.
Yeah.
I can see how you can influence 8 people, 12 people. How do you signify to 25,000 people, many of them with terrific financial needs, educating kids? I mean, how do you even do that? Okay, I've got a 15-year-old, and I don't know how I'm going to do
it. Michael, you said you had a question for the governor, too, please?
No, but I didn't get to my main point.
Oh, sure.
You must require Hollywood to get the accents right.
Yeah,
I was on I was on a radio program the other day, and someone asked me to mimic a Boston accent. The person who was asking me was a native Chicagoan, as I was, and I tried to do it, and he said, "Nah, it didn't work." So I get it; it's hard to get the accent just right unless you're from here.
Michael, thanks
for
the call,
Governor. I'm sure you tried Wicked Had.
I tried Wicked Had.
Thank you. Thanks, Michael.
Governor Patrick is with us till the top of the hour. You can ask questions of the governor at 877-301-8970 or email him at bpr@wgbh.org and catch the webcast at wgbhnews.org as well. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH.
Charlie Sennett, co-founder of Global Post and head of the Ground Truth Project.
We're looking at human rights stories around the world. We're looking at religious extremism. We're looking at global health. And we're trying to take those stories that feel so far away and so distant out there in the world and bring them home through strong storytelling. And when we're here at WGBH Radio, through really bringing in the local angle.
The Ground Truth Project, now a partner with WGBH News.
Support for WGBH comes from you and the Boston Speaker Series, proudly presented by Lesley University, with 7 evenings at Symphony Hall. Waiting list information available at bostonspeakerseries.org. Sponsored by Dedham Savings. And Dover Rug and Home, rugs, carpeting, hard surfaces, and window treatments for today's lifestyle and many budgets. You can visit Dover Rug's Labor Day event in Natick and coming soon in Back Bay, Boston.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. We are joined by the governor of the Commonwealth, as we are every month. He's here to take your questions, your emails, your calls, all those sort of things till 1 o'clock. Governor, before we get back to the calls, you mentioned a minute ago that you had done another radio appearance, which is a little troubling to both of us.
Very troubling.
But we're not going to get into that because we're not small. We wonder if...
I checked my contract.
The radio appearance that you were talking about was one in which I think you describe a fairly interesting... I don't know if it was a campaign stop or something along the way. Here's a little piece of that from what we understand.
Seniors vote, and they're really great, and they have terrific insights and so on, but they are deeply flirtatious.
No.
Deeply, deeply flirtatious.
So you're telling me...
I have had my backside pinched by any number.
No!
Of people.
Yes.
Yeah, I went into this one senior center, and this woman came up to me, and she said, Governor, she said, I'm a cougar. Yeah. And I didn't know what she was talking about, so I said, I'm a Leo. It's rough out there, everybody.
By the way, that was the governor on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the brilliant NPR show. You did it from Western Mass last week, right?
We did, from Tanglewood, yeah.
It was really fun.
Oh, before we move on from that, is that true? People have actually pinched your butt?
Oh, you have no idea.
Really?
You have no idea.
Wow. God, they had their way with you,
Governor Patrick. I told the story about Diane being at a senior center with Vicky Kennedy. I think it was in the last election. She was making a pitch. She was my surrogate for that day, and she was making a pitch for me. And she said that this wonderful guy said to her, "Come closer," and she came a little closer and she assumed he was having trouble hearing. He said to her again, "Come closer." And she came a little closer and leaned in close. And he said, "Can you sit on my lap?"
Oh! Oh, my gosh.
It's the beauty of politics. Gosh. Our number is 877-301-8970. That's the voice, obviously, of Governor Deval Patrick.
Actually, that was your voice.
Well, that was my voice. That is correct.
Before I get back to the calls, I hate to ruin the jovial mood here, but we have some emails. People are very still upset about the health connector. They're still upset about not getting there. And Michael from Roxbury is one of them, said he's not getting the insurance that he wants. We have a letter, email from Susan in Brookline, who wants to know, and this has to do with the problems that the unemployment office, the Globe's had a couple of stories last couple of days.
UI Online. Yeah.
Yes. Wants to know what the process is for vetting a company for a $46 million job, which is paid to Deloitte Consulting for the work on the unemployment system. Mm-hmm. The Globe indicated massive negligence, the product and there and the product and customer service. LA Times apparently did a big piece on them a while ago.
Deloitte.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And she says, you know, confusion for months. Some people got too much in their checks, others got too little. How does this company continue to work for public institutions?
So first of all, to Michael, is that the name of the person?
Yes, Michael is having very serious problems with his health insurance.
Well, that has nothing to do with the connector. So if Michael wants to stay on the line, or you said it's an email.
We'll forward the email.
Forward the email, yes. And we'll try to get his situation sorted out. I will say, by the way, that the team is making really, really good progress in fixing the connector website. I am hopeful. Obviously, we don't want to celebrate before it's time to celebrate. But I think we'll be ready for the open enrollment season in November, and that's good. Deloitte failed us, frankly, as CGI in the case of the connector failed us. You hire independent private sector experts, and you think they're going to perform. And in the case of Deloitte, they did not. And they have inconvenienced a lot of people. It's not the thousands of people that the Globe referenced. It's somewhere between 100 and 300 people. But for them, it's pretty serious, right? And pretty worrisome. Those issues have been worked out now, UI Online is functioning well. I do think there's some lessons, though, and this may go to the centerpiece of the question that you were reading to me. You know, today in IT, the notion of these mega contracts for big companies is not really consistent with the best practices in IT today. You know, more and more of these projects are done successfully, both on the public and the private side, in smaller bites, with local companies who are trying new things. You know, and you take it in. These smaller bytes, and then you put the bytes together. I'm not describing it the way an IT expert will, but you understand what I mean?
Yes, I do.
Rather than saying, I want this thing with all these customized bells and whistles, you say instead, this is what I need this thing to do. I need it to produce these kinds of reports and outcomes on the internal side, and I need it to be friendly in these ways on the outward-facing side. How can you help me solve that? And I think having our new CIO, who has been a tremendous help in helping everybody understand this, all of the technology officials in the various agencies, having them report to him rather than to the subject matter experts who are the secretaries or the leaders of particular agencies, I think is also important and helpful.
But there I think it's fair to say there has been a rollout problem of late. Not all technology connected. The medical marijuana thing we talked about, the connector you mentioned. When the three candidates for governor on the Democratic side are asked to criticize you, they all swallow hard and don't want to. But generally, when there is a criticism, it's about these rollouts that have been flawed.
I think those are fair points. They don't diminish the many, many other successes we have, but sometimes things go wrong. And the website connector, I've said before, the main event in healthcare reform is not whether the website works. It's whether people are getting access to care. This is why I said Michael should forward the email. Because in fact, even while CGI was failing us on the connector website, we've added more than 100,000 more people to affordable health care. We are at 99%, I think it is now, total insured. So, yes, we need a website that works as the convenience it's supposed to be, particularly if we're going to spend the kind of money we have spent. And we're going to get just that, and we're going to get it before I leave office. So I think, the lessons I mentioned around a better way to do IT are lessons learned, and some of them have been baked into practice, and some of them are actually in statute now, which is really good.
Before we get back
to the calls, you are kind of like the Tom Menino here in this race because, as Jim just pointed out, the Democrats don't want to criticize you. It reminds me very much of when Tom Menino was running. He was the greatest mayor in the history of Boston, and you've done—
When he was not running,
and the other candidates were all running, the first thing everybody did was say, oh, great. You must have noticed that, Governor Patrick.
I'm still a relative amateur in politics or elective politics anyhow. This is the only job I've run for. So I still believe that there is or ought to be more to campaigns and more to your reason for wanting to serve than that the person who's doing the job now is bad. The question is not just what they do. What are you going to do? I think that all of the Democratic candidates have gone to appropriate lengths, not just distinguishing themselves from me, which I think is secondary, but talking about their own vision, where they want to take the Commonwealth. I will say I think that differs from what we're hearing from the putative Republican nominee.
Let's go back to the phones, Governor Patrick.
Let's see. Marjorie is calling from Jamaica Plain. Marjorie, are you there?
Hi there.
I am. Thank you.
Thank you for holding on.
First of all, Governor, I'd like to thank you for your years of service.
Thank you.
When you were first elected in office, within a couple of months of your election, you brought up the issue of casinos.
Mm-hmm.
And that started a process of Massachusetts getting into the casino business.
Mm-hmm.
Today, the one difference that I can see between Tolman and Healy is that Mr. Tolman is a big supporter of the casinos and Ms. Healy is not.
Mm. You're wondering if that's my reasoning?
I think you got some skin in this game. I think that—
You mean as they say in the casinos?
Yeah, as they say in the casinos. And one of the things that's happened since you've come in is that the economics around casinos have really changed.
Yeah.
New Jersey's shutting them down.
Yeah.
They're left with the social issues behind their and the other economics that have changed is that Massachusetts, by your own words, is really, really strong.
Yeah.
So it seems to me that this support of Mr. Tolman, I'm just wondering that you're the businessman. This is being a large business supporter, not a small business supporter.
Yeah.
Being an activist AG is somebody who's going to, I don't know, the language worries me a little bit. So
you want to know if it was a factor.
What's your vested interest?
Yeah. No, thank
you, Governor.
Thank you for the question, Marjorie. I mean, Senator Warren and I disagree on the casino question, but I support her too. I mean, the casinos have never been a centerpiece of our economic growth strategy. They aren't now. They haven't ever been, as I say, and they weren't a factor in my support for Warren. I think Maura is great. I've said it to her. I've said it publicly, and I will say again that I think whatever the outcome in the Democratic primary, the people of Massachusetts would be well served by these Democratic candidates. In Warren's case, he is someone I've known for 20 years. He's been and enormously important and helpful ally as I've been doing this job, and indeed in particular in the 2010 campaign. And when I talk about an activist AG, I'm talking about beyond the part of the job that we should all expect and would get from either of these candidates, and that is effective enforcement of the law, but how you use the influence of the office to improve the lives of people and small businesses in the Commonwealth. And that ranges, in my view, to from gun safety to healthcare costs to civil rights. And I'm quite confident that Warren would be that kind of AG.
Speaking of civil rights, Marjorie, thank you for your call. Governor, we haven't seen you since the horror of Ferguson, Missouri.
Yeah.
And in addition to wanting to get your thoughts as the former head of the Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department and as a human, if you could also comment on something that was in the Globe 2 days ago, which has some relevance there, that in the most ethnically and racially diverse major communities of Boston, of Massachusetts, in many of them, there is a deep disconnect between the percentage of the population, which is of color, and the percentage of the police force. One example they picked was, for example, Lawrence, where 20% of the population is white, yet 77% of the police force is white. So if you could talk about both, I'd appreciate it.
Well, that's a concern. It has been, of course, for decades in this country. And we used to have programs in Massachusetts and elsewhere that tried to address that, and they have been challenged in recent times in the Supreme Court, and it's harder to do through so-called affirmative action. You know, the state police is another force where proportion of minorities who serve is relatively small. Although I will say, in the two classes, they're just adding there many more women and people of color, which is a great step forward and something that they've been trying to work on. So I do think that is a thing to pay attention to for those who are running law enforcement agencies. But I think there's another part to pay attention to, which was captured in an article I read, I think, in the New York Times recently, that compared the follow-on from the shooting in Ferguson to one in South L.A. around the same time. I don't know if you saw
this. You mean the TV producer? Oh, shooting you're talking about,
shooting.
As opposed to arrest.
No,
I'm sorry.
No,
what do you mean follow-on?
So in Ferguson, of course, there was a complete breakdown of law,
right,
in the wake of it. And many people attribute this to the reaction of the police, the leadership of the police. And I think, I'm taking from your question, Jim, the composition of the police force. And I've spoken to that. But the other part of it is the relationship between the police force and the people they serve. And the point that was made in this New York Times comparison was that there had also been a shooting of an unarmed young black man in South L.A. And the place didn't – and there were protests. And the place didn't go up in flames. In fact, the
police – By a white police officer?
I think it was by a white police officer. I think it was by a white police officer. The police were out during the protests on bikes. They were not in riot gear. And as they developed the story, they talked about how since the riots way back, you know, I want to say now 20 years ago, following Rodney King, and that the police have really worked hard to build relationships with the leaders and with the individual citizens in the community. So when they were ready to protest, somebody in the community called the police and said, this is what we're going to do. We need you to know. And you know, they have that kind of – that's what community policing is about, by the way. So my point is that the composition of law enforcement agencies, that's enormously important, something we've been working on at the state level. I think the gateway cities have been working on as well and should within the constraints of existing law. But the other part of it is how you get out and know – the people you serve and have them know you and build those relationships of trust, which is one of the things that law enforcement tells us is also a formula for effective crime solving.
Well, there's also the issue of the militarization of police post 9/11.
No, I get that.
President Obama's talked about that too, where cops are out there in these military-like vehicles.
The surplus.
And these military-like outfits. What do you think about that?
I don't know how to think about that. You know, in the wake of the terrorist attacks here at the marathon, we were awfully glad to have a lot of that equipment and people trained in how to use it. And I think the question is not whether they have it, but whether they use it at appropriate times.
What do you think about the president? I'm sorry.
In general? Okay,
sure.
Well, I know what you think about him in general, but he's really struggling in the polls these days. Are you seeing something that much of America is missing?
Well, I think the president is I love this president. I think he's great. I think he's got an enormously challenging job. Not just because the world is losing a grip on some of the basic rules of civilization, and I'm thinking in this context in particular about these recent beheadings. That sort of thing would be hard enough. But he's been dealing with the Congress, some of whom are determined to cause this president to fail, even if it means that the nation fails, and that's an unusual moment I think patriotic challenge, and I worry about him, but I think he's doing fine, and you know polls can come and go. You and I both know that.
Let's go back to the calls. Governor Deval Patrick.
Let's see. Alex is calling from Lincoln. Alex, are you there?
Hey, Alex.
Yes, I am. I'm here, Governor.
Can you hear me okay? Something's the matter with my headset.
Can you hear him? Speak again.
I can hear you guys.
Can you
hear me?
As long as you can hear me. I'm getting you, but it's just move.
Okay, great. So, Governor, I know that you're very well aware of one of the best programs at the Department of Public Health, which is the Early Intervention Program.
Yes.
Okay. And would you agree that it is the best, most important program?
Okay, Alex.
Wait, hold on.
I know I'm being led somewhere. Where are you,
Alex?
I know. Services to infants and toddlers with disabilities.
Yeah.
And one of the reasons is that we actually save the cities and towns around the state about $30 million a year by reducing the need for special education costs for kids.
Yeah.
And we also have wonderful legislative support. So here's my question. It has been 8 years since we have received an official rate increase for our services. The human service providers around the state that provide EI are losing hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars, trying to participate in this program due to inadequate rates. Can you explain why the Secretary of Human Services has not done an analysis of the budget that we need to run our programs and why we have not received the benefit of Chapter 257?
I was going to ask you, Alex, if that's what you were talking about. Yeah, so Alex, first, before I try to respond to your question, let me just explain for others what Chapter 257 is, okay? And you step in if I don't get it right. But Chapter 257 was an initiative, I think I signed into law, that was meant—
With unanimous support of the legislature, including Republicans.
Yes, that was meant to basically rationalize the rates set for a whole variety of human services providers. Because I think it is fair to say, Alex, that for a long time, if you were a politically connected provider, you got a better rate specified. If you were a less politically connected provider, your rate was not as robust. And we were just kind of doing stuff on top of what we'd always done rather than thinking in fresh ways about the budget from a state perspective, from the agency's perspective, who was working in them, what the real needs were and how to get to a rate that made more sense.
It's the cost of doing business, having appropriate staff, and following all government mandates for the service.
Right.
That's what the law says.
Right. So we had a setback, as you may recall, called the Great Recession that slowed us all down. And because everybody's rate is different, so interesting, I get these questions. I was going to say, Alex, because everybody's rate is different, the analysis is taking a while because you got to go through different sectors, different agencies. You can imagine that for some agencies that have been getting a relatively rich rate in the past, they have been very organized and very resistant to having their rates rationalized. And for others, they're like it sounds like you are, whose rates have been chronically low or have been lower for a long time or not raised for a long time. They're feeling impatient.
The Alex, let the governor finish his thought, if you can.
And
sorry.
I'm sorry. I'll stop, Alex. The other thing I was going to say is it's interesting. I get these questions from a variety of people, and some people say, thank you so much for increasing the rates because the secretary has gotten to them, and others saying, as you have, why is it taking so long?
Well, here's the thing. I understand that some programs have done well and are on a much firmer footing. Early intervention was supposed to get the secretary's attention 2 years ago, and that process was delayed. It's not a funding issue. As you know, there are many legislators. Wait a minute. Many legislators love and support the early intervention program. I'm thinking of Representatives Kafka, Walsh, Tom Conroy, Senator DiDomenico, Alex, when he was still in office.
Alex, we didn't invite you to debate the governor. We asked you to ask him a question.
No, it's okay. I mean, these are serious issues, and Alex has raised a serious question. I understand his impatience. It's not true that it's not about the money. We asked for more to support Chapter 257 from the legislature, and we didn't get as much as we asked for, and we have to deal with that. And I apologize for the slowness of it, but I am proud of the thoroughness of it. And I think Chapter 257, as it is being implemented, will be one of the long-term positive contributions of this administration, working with partners like you.
Alex, thank you for the call. Governor, Marjorie asked you about the president's poll numbers. Let me ask you about the president's meals. You went to Martha's Vineyard with your wife to eat with the Obamas. What'd they serve? Was it just the four of you, or was it a large group?
No, there were 10 of us, I think, altogether.
What'd you eat? You being the chef.
Yeah, what did we eat? I think shrimp and grits.
Ooh, that sounds pretty good.
Yeah.
How swank were the accommodations?
They were using a house I want to say in Tisbury,
yeah.
West Tisbury.
Must have been pretty nice.
It was nice, yeah.
Yeah, I bet.
Great views.
Yeah,
You know, one of the things that is either a subject of marvel or criticism is how the president handles stress. And the most incredible example I can think of, I don't know if you saw it, is one of the years when he's speaking at the White House Press Correspondents' Dinner, and Seth Meyers is making jokes about the MC, about bin Laden. Obama had already given the order to get him, and he's laughing. And I mean, in your private dealings, how does he handle the world exploding around him, whether it's on Capitol Hill, whether it's in Syria and Iraq? How does he handle that in his personal life?
I think, you know, in my private dealings, a dinner with 10 people is different from a one-on-one conversation, it would be with me. And, you know, he's present. But I don't think people should be surprised to know that he's deeply affected by the stuff he's dealing with, because he sees the human beings behind those decisions. You know, whether they are about programs or military actions, and whether they affect Americans, which I think he is duty bound and personally inclined to think of first, or other human beings. He sees those human beings, and you've got to believe it weighs on him.
And one last thing about this is he took a lot of criticism, and I have to say I was amongst them, for the optics. And I know you were not a fan of optics in politics. I know you in any case. When he was on the Vineyard.
Just keep going.
And he made an incredibly moving statement. I think it was about the execution of James Foley from New Hampshire, and soon thereafter he was out playing golf. How does he handle – and he was roundly criticized, including by some Democrats. How does the president handle personal criticism? Does he accept this as just part of the job, or how does he handle this?
I'm not with him all the time.
No, of course.
My sense is that that it affects him, but then you have to keep going. Sometimes a constructive critique is used by people who are trying to drive another agenda and inflated. And what are you supposed to do with that? How do you process the constructive part of it and leave off the rest of it, which is just a political opportunism? I've been working on that myself.
We only have a minute left. And by the way, as always, all calls that are unreached, we'll get your phone number. If you stay on hold, they'll be forwarded to the governor's office. Emails forwarded as well. What's atop your agenda with 3 months to go?
Well, we've got, we're working really hard to get the Connector website right. And while I am optimistic, I have a daily phone call with the leader of the team to check in on that. And I'm hopeful about that. We got to close out this Medicaid waiver. That's probably a little more technical than you care about, but it is support that the federal government has been giving Massachusetts since the Bush administration to enable our own healthcare reform to be as successful as it is. And we've negotiated two extensions of the waivers over the 8 years, and we want to get this one in place before the next administration comes in so they don't have that to worry about. There are a couple of other things we're trying to do on the economic development side, because there's always work to do. There are some announcements we hope to make. I'm going to make one more trip, at least one more trip, I think the week after next or before the end of the month overseas to close a couple of those deals. So that's the sort of thing I'll be working on.
Speaking of the next administration, a couple of minutes, we're going to be joined by Charlie Baker, who you ran against before, and he's running for governor again. Charlie Baker, I think you might have heard of me. You have any questions you suggest we should ask Mr. Baker?
Well, I'm sure you'll think of some. I'm sure you think of some. Yeah, I hope everybody just keeps it positive and they are about the future.
You got any advice?
That's it.
Governor, it's good to see you.
Good to be with you.
We will see you in a month. Governor Deval Patrick, again, don't hang up if you want your phone call transmitted to the governor's office. Governor, good to see you. Thanks.
It is great to see Governor Patrick, who joins us every month for Ask the Governor. Up next, as I said, it's another variation on Ask the Governor. We'll ask gubernatorial candidate Charlie Baker about what direction he'd take the state in under his leadership. It is our final interview with the candidate before next week's primary on Tuesday. Of course, stay tuned to 89.7 WGBH.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Today we are wrapping up it's our final interview with the gubernatorial candidates before next week's primary. Here with us in Studio 3 is Charlie Baker. As you know, Charlie is running for the Republican nomination. Charlie Baker, good to see you.
How are you guys? Good afternoon.
Very well. Excellent. Thank you for coming in. So, you got any predictions for Tuesday's election on the Democratic side?
I have no predictions.
You have no predictions?
No predictions.
Yeah, how about your side?
I'm hoping and expecting to win.
Okay.
But every candidate ought to be hoping and expecting to win when they're 5 days out from an election.
Do you have a favorite you'd like to run against in the Democratic side?
No, I don't. I know them all. I like them all. I think they're all a lot more interested in what I would describe as a much bigger government and a lot more taxes at a point in time when I think most voters in Massachusetts are looking for a governor who's going to, what I would describe as reform a lot of the ways the state does business and look to find opportunities to save money.
Have you watched the debates among the Democrats?
Some, but running my own race, and that does complicate things a bit.
There is a debate tonight. That
there
Mr.
is. Where is that, Marjorie?
Is on NACN at 6 o'clock.
I will make sure I watch that one.
And you'll be doing one tomorrow, too.
Now, here's the suck-up. Primarily because I think the guy who's moderating is just really
okay,
good.
Fine. Yeah. Now, Charlie, speaking of fawning,
I hope you remember that tomorrow night.
The Globe endorses Charlie Baker. Charlie Baker for governor. And, well, I hope they're not offended when I say it's essentially a fawning endorsement. And one line, typical, he's a creative manager committed to rooting out waste and finding new ways to solve problems. However, here's another quote. Baker offers nothing like a competing vision. He's talking about the man who would be your predecessor, who you ran against, Deval Patrick. Only a nuts and bolts fix to the bureaucratic machine. But after all the cracks are mended, leaks plugged, which way does the ship sail? Mapping out a larger agenda for the state's success will be a key challenge if and when Baker secures the GOP nomination. Do they have a point?
No, I don't. They don't have a point, although it was a wonderful endorsement, and I would certainly never want to say anything bad about anybody who was involved in writing that one, okay?
So were they wrong? What's the Baker vision, Charlie?
The Baker vision is a competitive Massachusetts, not one that's competitive here but not there. I mean, if you travel around the Commonwealth of Mass, which I've obviously been doing a lot of for the better part of the past year, there are a lot of parts of Massachusetts that are doing quite well, and there are a lot of parts of Massachusetts that aren't. And in fact, my first campaign event when I got into the race was the Emerging Technology Center at UMass Lowell. And the reason I went there was because it was in Lowell, which is a gateway city. It was outside Route 128. We all know that the economy inside 128 is different than outside. And it was a great public-private partnership between UMass and a whole bunch of plastics and polymer manufacturers up in the Merrimack Valley that's creating real stickiness for the employers and a great reason for them to continue to grow and expand there, and at the same time creating sort of a sense of reality for the faculty there about what people are really looking for in terms of the science of that industry, and a runway for kids into employment. And that was why I went there, because one of my major concerns and one of my major goals as governor is to make sure we put strategies in place around the Commonwealth to try to make sure we create economic opportunity everywhere.
And is that, I assume that's the reason why you have said that even though you will vote against repeal on the casino question, if it's repealed, you'd file legislation to allow Springfield to have Mohegan Sun. Is that is that the basis for that?
It's MGM. Mohegan.
What did I say?
Oh,
I'm sorry, MGM. My apologies. Yeah.
I think I'm the only candidate who's actually walked the site out there. And if you've walked the site, it cuts right through the part of the city that got demolished by the tornado. And it's also right along I-91, which they need to retrofit so they can bring the river back to the city. And the fact that this project is designed in such a way so that it's not all-encompassing, there's a casino associated with it, but all the retail and the restaurant stuff is going to be done outside the casino as an ancillary part of the casino. So they're basically going to create main streets that are sort of bustling areas that people can access who are both at the casino but also are simply live in the area. And the ability to tie what they're doing from an entertainment point of view to the Civic Center out there. I mean, there's a lot of really good components to that in a place that I don't see anybody else standing up to invest $800 million, and they need something to kickstart that economy.
But you're a direct democracy guy. I know you're correct me if I'm wrong.
Yep.
And essentially, and one who says the voters speak, and I obviously nobody should ever say that it's just a law. It doesn't mean the legislature can't fix or amend or whatever. But does it not concern you that if the voters speak on November 4th, and the way they speak is to repeal the law, you're elected governor on the same day. You're sworn in 2 months later. One of the first things you file is something that flies completely in the face of what the popular mandate is.
Well,
is that not concerning?
Well, as you know, I've been a one casino person all along.
Yes, and that is totally true.
And if the voters want to reject having three or four casinos in Massachusetts, I think that's absolutely their prerogative. But I don't think there's anything wrong after that, since people did vote 60-40 for the casino in Springfield, to give voters out there sort of their day in court. And if the legislature chooses not to go forward, the legislature chooses not to go forward. But from my point of view, I'm one of those people who said that this question should be on the ballot, that the voters ought to have an opportunity to vote on it. And I was very specific about that from the get-go. And I'm glad that it is on the ballot. And I think it was unfortunate that the Attorney General, for whatever reason, chose to delay getting it on the ballot.
You know, one of the things you hear all the time about those outside of 128, you know, belt and the difference in the economy in Boston outside there is because the big media market is in Boston too. So if you're the governor, you may be doing great things out in Northampton. Nobody's going to care about that in Boston.
Well, but the people in Northampton will, and I think that's important. I mean, I've spent a lot of time talking to employers out in Springfield, just to stay in that area for a minute. There are 3,000 machinists who work in the Pioneer Valley. And at any given time, there are somewhere between 500 and 1,000 jobs for skilled workers open out there. And they don't have issues with the price of real estate. They don't have issues with the cost of labor. Their big problem, and they've said this to me, is that they can't find enough skilled workers to fill the jobs they have. And one of the things I've said a lot during this race, getting back to whether or not I have a vision, is that we need to do a better job of leveraging our vocational and technical schools, because there are a lot of employment opportunities there. And either make it possible for them to start developing associate degree programs so kids can literally just go straight through high school, do the 1 or 2 years, and get the degree they need to go right to work, or they need to be working with community colleges who want to work with them to create opportunities for kids to do the same. I mean, I don't know if either of you have ever been to the Ben Franklin Institute, which is over on Berkeley Street here.
I have not.
No.
You should have those people in for a chat. They do 1 and 2 year degrees in computer science, automotive technology, electricians, HVAC, plumbing, and they literally, in about a month, they're going to start getting phone calls from employers and labor unions saying, how many kids you got graduating this year in each of your programs, because we want to hire them all. And I think there's a lot of opportunity there that we're missing.
You know, Charlie, you've mentioned, talked a lot. We're talking to Charlie Baker, one of the Republicans running in the primary on Tuesday against Mark Fisher. You've talked a lot about workers in the last couple of minutes. Last night, you say you didn't watch the consortium
debate. I haven't seen it yet, but
well,
I will.
I watched it last night, and I think your name only came up once, actually. And the context in which it came up is, I think Martha Coakley started the conversation, and all the other two agreed that she wants to take you on this whole sick leave thing. There's a ballot question,
yep,
which would, and I'll give you the short version for people who are not familiar with it yet. You'll be voting on this. Employees who work for employers which have 11 or more employees could earn and use up to 40 hours of paid sick time per calendar year. If you work for a smaller employee, you can employer, excuse me, 40 hours of unpaid sick time per calendar year. Where are you on this right now, and why?
I think we should. I think we should create a what I would describe as a far more flexible sick time approach here in Massachusetts. I mean, one of my big concerns, and by the way, I'm a ballot question guy. So if the thing passes and I get elected governor, I'll do everything I can to implement it and enforce it.
But you're going to vote against it.
But I am going to vote against it. And the main reason I'm going to vote against it is because there are a lot of employers who currently have flex programs of one sort or another that combine sick time with vacation time and earned time and other forms of earned time and they work. And one of my big concerns about this is people will lose some portion of a program that's already in place and working for them if you pass a one-size-fits-all law.
Why
I absolutely
they work
believe
in a place
we should do something on this, but I would like it to be a lot more flexible, because I think there are unintended consequences, just as there have been in things like healthcare reform and other big initiatives that at 30,000 feet everybody says sound great, but then turn out to have real consequences for people on the ground.
What do you do in a place that doesn't have a pre-existing flex time arrangement or whatever?
Well, that's why I think we should pursue a model that makes it possible for people to participate in a program like this. I would just like it to be a lot broader and have a lot more options so that people can figure out what works for their business and what works for them.
We're talking to Charlie Baker, who, by the way, has a tie on today, which is very disappointing
to
both me and Marjorie. I mean, the new you. Come on, don't make a face at us. Isn't this part of the new you?
The new me.
There's a new you, and we read this in every article. There's a new Charlie Baker as compared to. Why are you smirking? Why is it? There is a new Charlie Baker. Finish the thought. Is there not a new you?
I certainly think that the second time through, I learned a lot from the first time, and it's like a lot of things. The second time through, I just think you're more familiar with what's going to happen and what's going to go on, and for me anyway, that just makes me a little more comfortable with the whole thing. As far as the tie thing is concerned, if I had known the last time I ran that I could get away without wearing a tie, I wouldn't have.
You know, we talked a lot about in here about the probation department scandal when John O'Brien and some of his associates were found guilty of a job rigging deal. I know you've talked about the inspector yep. general getting involved and so forth. He didn't get anything for his own personal gain, but he didn't make money, redo his house or anything. But he's facing up to 20 years in jail, John O'Brien, the former head of probation. How much jail time do you think he should do?
Well, since I wasn't, I mean, you guys and I, you and I have talked on the air over the years about a lot of trials,
yep.
okay? And I've always said to you that I think it's difficult and sometimes inappropriate for people who don't actually sit through the trial mm-hmm. to comment on what they think happened in the trial based on what they saw in the paper. My view on this one is I think he got a fair trial. I have no problem at all with the verdict. It was obvious that there was some There are a lot of people who got jobs they weren't qualified for, and there was a tremendous amount of effort made to sort of paper that over. But this is a classic example of where the judge ought to be in charge of figuring out what the penalty is that fits the crime. I will say that my primary recommendation on what to do about this going forward has not been endorsed by anybody on the Democratic side, and to me is just another example of the difference between the way I'm thinking about cleaning up Beacon Hill and the way they're thinking about it. And it's a pretty simple proposal, which is state publishes all of its jobs online when they're available. All I want to do is make sure that when somebody gets hired, the state publishes who got the job, their resume, and whether or not they got any recommendations from anybody in state service. I think that all by itself will go a long way to cleaning up some of the concerns people have about people getting jobs that they're not entitled to get because of who they know instead of what they know. Can't get anybody on the Democratic side to endorse doing even that.
When Bill Weld was the governor, you worked for Bill Weld, there was the so-called walruses. There was the people that were supposedly the patronage hires during the Weld administration. So obviously Republicans aren't immune from putting people into jobs that have helped them in campaigns. Is that okay?
If somebody's qualified for the job, I don't think we should ever be concerned about that. The real issue here is you don't want to put people into positions they're not qualified for, especially important ones. And that's the reason why I think my proposal, which would shed a lot of light on who actually gets hired and whether or not they have the skills to do the job, would be an easy way, frankly, for people to get a really good sense about who actually gets
hired. But you're implying the Democrats don't really want to clean it up. Is that what you're saying?
I'm saying that this is a pretty simple thing to do, and it would seem to me that they could have embraced it.
Speaking of Bill Weld, who obviously was governor here for quite a while, for whom you worked, and he is a mentor of sorts. Is he? I mean, it's not...
He's setting me up here.
No, it's no. There's no. No, actually, it sounds like a set. But I mean, you do consider him a mentor, right?
Absolutely.
I know you do.
Yeah.
One of the reasons I would argue that Weld had legislative success, particularly in the early stages of his governorship, was because he had enough Republicans in the state Senate to sustain a veto. When the Democrats did something he didn't like under Bill Baldrige, I guess it was in those days, even though they were sort of friendly, he could sustain a veto. Even by the most optimistic projection, there are not going to be enough Republicans if you're elected governor for you to be able to do the same with an overwhelmingly Democratic legislature without the ability to sustain a veto, at least in the first 2 years of your governorship, should you win. How do you get anything done?
Well, we got a lot done beyond the first 2 years, Jim. I mean, education reform and welfare reform and health care reform and county government reform and the pension. I mean, we got a lot of stuff done that took place after we lost the veto in the Senate.
But how you start does matter, does it not? Because you get momentum, the public becomes convinced you can do something.
Well, I would say we have some terrific candidates running for state rep and state Senate, and I think many of them are have really good chances to win. And I do think we can increase our numbers, increase balance on Beacon Hill. And I also think, frankly, that if the voters choose to elect me as governor, they'll be sending a message to the Democrats and to the legislature about the fact that they like balance and they want what I call the constructive friction of both teams on the field. And I think people will be amenable to that.
What do you think of Bob DeLeo, who will be the speaker, should he be governor, and Stan Rosenberg from Western Mass, who will likely be the new Senate president?
Well, Stan Rosenberg was the Ways and Means chair in the Senate when I was A&F secretary. So I've known him for a long time. And I've always had a good working relationship with him. Bob DeLeo I've known for probably 10 years, plus or minus. And he's a huge fan of some of the same things I'm a huge fan of, like charter schools. And I think I can work with him. I also, by the way, never had any trouble working with other people in the legislature as well. And as I said, I do think there will be more reform-oriented Republicans up there come January as well.
Did Carmen Ortiz, the U.S. attorney, treat Bob DeLeo fairly? Unindicted co-conspirator, never had an opportunity to be in a courtroom and respond to charges. He defended himself, said the jury verdict essentially exonerated him. But putting that aside, was he treated fairly by the U.S. attorney?
You know, I think the U.S. attorney had a case to try, and I wasn't part of any of the conversations about strategically how she thought she needed to try it. She felt that it was important to make the argument about how the loop got closed and all the rest. That was her call, and I think that's her decision.
talking with Charlie Baker, who's running for governor in Massachusetts in the Republican ticket. The primary, of course, is Tuesday. Charlie, you just mentioned...
Yes, the primary is Tuesday.
It's Tuesday.
I hope you say that
it's
a lot
Tuesday.
Today.
It is
I'm
Tuesday.
I'm trying to, because people get confused. I thought it was a week from Thursday, but I've been straightened out. Anyway,
really
no, she
I'm only teasing.
No, I'm sorry. Yes, she
I'm
did.
I'm only teasing.
2 days ago, you said there were
Thursday.
10 days to go
I
when it was 8
days
ago.
My math was off.
That could have just been math.
That's right. My math was off. But anyway, you just mentioned welfare reform during the Weld administration. There's been a lot of talk about what's wrong with welfare. I know that your running mate, Karen Polito's, talked about this some too, the EBT card abuse, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But thinking of your mentor, Bill Weld, I remember when he ran for governor, he hammered a lot on welfare reform and problems with welfare. Yep. And he's done very well in his life, and you've done very well in your life. Don't you worry that the kinder, gentler Charlie Baker might look a little less kind and gentle pounding on welfare if it becomes a major issue in the race?
This has always been interesting to me, that if you're really interested in helping people get off public assistance and up on their own two feet, that somehow that's bad. I've never been able to figure that out, Marjorie, to tell you the truth. I mean, I was out at visiting the Worcester Public Housing Authority last week, which is operated by Ray Mariano, who is the former mayor of Worcester and a Democrat and grew up in public housing. And he has a program that he's put in place where it's a nudge at this point. He would like it to be a little more than a nudge. And what he is doing is providing education support for people so they get their GEDs, ESL for those who need to work on their English, and not just job training, but also sort of work training. You know, how do you interview? How do you write a resume? What might you be qualified to do? And I went out and visited him, and he walked me into a room with about 10 people who've all participated in this program, all of whom said that it was something that they really didn't want to do. And he kind of pushed them into it a little bit. And they are all in various stages of either having gotten out of public housing. One guy's actually bought a house, or on their way to getting out of public housing. And they all want to be out of public housing. They all want to stand on their own. They all want to sort of have the dream that everybody desires in this country. And when I said to Ray, after the end of this, I said, so, you know, what's the state doing with this? You know, this is great stuff. And Ray said, actually, the state has fought me tooth and nail every inch of the way on this because it doesn't fit within the rules of the way public housing is supposed to work. And Ray's a Democrat. He is a city of Worcester guy. He is not, you know, sort of a hard-hearted person. He believes that this program is exactly the sort of thing we should be doing more of to help people who've spent he says point blank right there when you're talking to him, there are people in those public housing projects who've been there for 2 and 3 generations. And he said it's not a good thing. Our goal here ought to be to find a way to help these folks find their way out and to stand on their own. And I agree with that. I think the goal here should be, and if you look at the welfare reform proposal that we put out, it includes a lot of the same concepts and the same ideas that Ray's been pursuing. And I think we should be doing more of that.
Okay, one last thing from me,
Just
Charlie
like
Baker.
I feel like we shouldn't be leaving homeless families in hotels and motels. We should be coming up with solutions to get them out of those.
Amen.
Here. One last thing from me, Charlie Baker. Jim Browdy thinks that the reason you're doing well in the polls and the whole resuscitation of your career had to do with the fact that
I didn't wear a tie.
No.
Jim
came up with the brilliant idea of having you come on the radio with us. Remember you used to be on once a month before you ran for office?
I didn't put her up to that. But believe me, that was not my idea to
That's
say
what
that.
He said. He said, Charlie
Happens
Baker,
to be true,
oh,
but I didn't
to
say
me,
it.
So since Jim...
That is true, correct?
I think it's probably the single most important thing that's happened in my life.
Exactly.
Okay. Okay.
Exactly.
That may be a bit of an exaggeration.
Except for the marriage to my wonderful wife.
That's right. So we want to get a promise from you, Charlie Baker. Should you become the next governor of the Commonwealth, will you come in once a month like Governor DePatrick has done and take calls and emails and discuss the issues of the day?
I can't believe you guys even think you need to ask me that question.
What's the answer?
The answer is of course.
Of course.
Look, I have always enjoyed my time on the radio with you guys, and I'm sucking up again, and maybe I shouldn't be
That's
doing
okay.
that 4 days before an election. But I also have heard from a lot of people who are in your listening audience, you know, both before I got into the race and since I got into the race, that they really enjoyed the back and forth and the give and take between us, and that it helped them get a better understanding about what kind of person I was and how I think about things. And, you know, as I say all the time, that I'm the product of a Democratic mom and a Republican dad. And I grew up listening to both sides of the story my entire childhood. And I think in some respects, We don't have enough of that kind of conversation. That's exactly a big part of what I think I can bring to state government. Everybody talking to themselves who thinks the same way is not going to get us out of a jam. The way you get out of a jam is by broadening the horizon and thinking differently about things.
You're supposed to say before you go, and thank you very much for that. I'm really looking forward to the debate with Mark Fisher on your television show tomorrow night, Jim.
I am really looking forward to the debate tomorrow night with Mark Fisher on your program at 6 o'clock.
Thank you.
And the primary is on Tuesday.
Thank you very much,
Charlie.
Charlie, it's good to see you.
It's good to see you.
Good luck.
Thank you, Charlie, for coming in. Charlie Baker is a Republican running for governor. To learn more about his campaign, go to charliebaker2014.com. Up next, it's Rabbit Recycle. What happens when John Updike's trash is turned into a museum? Alex Beam joins us for that conversation next on 89.7 WGBH.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I forgot who I was just for a second. I am Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie. And if you're just tuning in,
thank you.
We're talking to Alex Beam. I'm sorry. My apologies. We're joined by Alex Beam.
I'm running for governor on a principled platform.
I was thrown off by a little.
No taxes for Alex
Beam.
More taxes for you.
I'm not done
exactly.
yet. He's a columnist for the Boston Globe.
Sorry.
His latest book is I'm reading the wrong. In any case, Alex, it's a pleasure to see you.
Can we start
this whole thing over again?
Yes,
welcome back to Boston Public Radio.
If you've used the transition moving from the sublime to the ridiculous, from Deval Patrick, Charlie Baker.
Oh no. I love this story. This is one of the best stories of all time. About the guy collecting trash, stealing the trash, dumpster diving outside.
Oh, let's get right into it. Okay, what's the deal? Hi, Alex.
Oh, forget the clever play on words about my name. I guess we'll use that next week.
Yes, we will.
All right. Paul Moran. I had to check his name. That's the name of the guy.
He's great. Tell people what he did. I just love this and what he found. It's great.
Well, they got to go to the Atlantic Magazine site and find this long article about Paul Moran and read my column on Saturday. He's a former resident of Salem, Massachusetts, who was bicycling in Beverly Farms in 2006 on one of these beautiful, you know, rural roads where John Updike lives. And I've actually been on that road, and it's all these trees hanging over. It's exactly where you'd want to live.
Yeah.
And he noticed.
For couples.
Yeah. It's like you want to get over on your neighbor, as they say.
In any
literally. That's the local patois, I think. In any event, this guy Moran, it's amazing. He somehow knows that Updike lives at number 82 or something, and he sees Updike's trash bags. And this is great. He sees that they've been opened. That they've been slid open, probably by somebody who wanted, you know, the bottles and cans.
Oh,
which doesn't quite track with me because are those people in Beverly Farms? But never mind. In any case, he claims the trash. He stopped and he exercised his rights as an American citizen, and put his paws right into John Updike's trash. And it's like story out of Sutter's Mill because he struck gold.
He
got the four honorary degrees.
Updike threw away.
It's an unbelievable story. The part that The Atlantic doesn't mention and that I also didn't know was that became a front page story in The Globe, apparently.
I didn't know that either.
I didn't know that. I don't remember reading that story.
How about the explicit love letter?
Well, that's later. Anyway, because this guy Moran, thus, he comes back because it's, of course, legal, as we know. You separate. You lose your Fourth Amendment privileges when you put your trash out. You know, Henry Kissinger lost a case on this against The Nation, which found classified material in his trash. And in 1988, there's a Supreme Court ruling, actually, that says the police can have your trash. You've lost your Fourth Amendment right to privacy.
Watch out.
When you put out your trash. In any case, he goes back for over a period of 3 years. And his motives, if you choose to ask me about them, I mean, are not exactly – we don't really know. But in any case,
why would we choose to ask you about them if we don't know?
Because I'm going to just bypass his motives because they're complex.
Okay.
They're clearly not exactly financial, although John Updike. Well, anyway, what he eventually finds, Updike is throwing out an amazing amount of stuff.
And was he doing this surreptitiously, by the way? Was he sneaking in under cover of darkness, or was he just brazenly
absolutely
going
not.
Up?
Absolutely not.
Right up there, broad
he knew
daylight.
Which day was trash day in Beverly Farms. And indeed, Updike's neighbors asked him once or twice what he was doing, and he said, I'm curating John Updike's trash.
Do you use plastic gloves?
And that I don't know.
Okay, so can
That's
I ask
a crucial question,
Alex. There's a lot of letters. a lot of letters, a lot of personal photographs, snapshots, and then all this weird kind of detritus of the average life, every canceled check, apparently, that Updike wrote. I mean, which, you know, again, you got to use your imagination. I mean, it's, you know, every canceled check, that's like a history of your life, right? That's the guy you lost to in golf.
Yeah.
But that's also the right-wing affinity group that you sent. I mean, it's sort of mind-boggling. And to get to the point, he has posted a lot of this material, in a sense, in an alternate John Updike archive on the internet. It's called johnupdikearchive.com.
Okay, so I have three very quick questions
yes.
for you. Ready? One, if you had to pick one icon, at least to you, whose trash you could go through, who would that be?
Well, Updike would be very close to the top.
Okay, number two, here's a quiz. You never participate in our Friday news quiz. Who is A.J. Weberman?
Who is A.J. Weber? I don't know.
A.J. Weberman is a man who is called a Dylanologist who on McDougal Street in the Village would go through Bob Dylan's trash and essentially was the Paul Moran of Bob Dylan decades before. He's written, I mean, he's huge.
He
I can't believe you haven't written
find?
About this. I have no idea. In any case.
Yeah, that would be more interesting what he found.
Yes,
that's number
exactly.
two. And here's the third. So what you get, the first one you sort
two.
Of get, well, the first one you did okay.
Oh, okay.
Third and final.
Yeah.
Who, what two people whom you know? One night, in the dark of night, I should say, went through the trash bags of the former governor, when he was governor, William Weld, in West Cambridge, I'd say at roughly midnight, in anticipation of a meeting with Michael Moore outside that governor's house, which never happened. Who were they?
It's obviously you and Marjorie.
That is exactly
you're
correct.
Out of your, that I is get credit for the first two because
you
I got
do.
The last
Great.
One right.
We went through
you
Bill Weld's trash. Yes, we did. We opened his garbage bags.
We did.
We ever admitted this
found
on the air before?
Lots of empty bottles of amber colored liquid.
Why did we do this? But it was
we were supposed to date of all time. That's
we
the greatest date ever.
We were supposed to. We were on NECN together briefly on that weekend thing. We were doing something with Michael Moore.
Who under stood the radar
us,
show.
Michael Moore stood us up. Oh, that's right. You wrote it under the radar. And that was our radio
radar.
Show.
I can't remember Marjorie was on that
Michael
show,
Moore
but I'm sure
stood
it was
us
huge.
Up. But I can't remember, in all truth, why it was that we felt a critical piece of this. We literally went through his garbage bags. And opened them up.
And what did you? So
nothing.
What did you
find, nothing, kinda? As I recall.
I don't know.
I was worried about not having my plastic gloves.
Oh yeah, that's like Ebola City,
yeah.
man.
I can't remember.
But I did go. I did go one time. It was a great story. Remember the time that John Kerry was run against a Bill Weld for the United States.
One of the
Senate?
Great races in
and
the
was,
history
and
of
was,
American
and
politics.
It was Halloween,
1996.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. Eight
and it was
debates.
Halloween.
Was it?
And yeah, there was a big story because the news crews are going over to Bill Weld's house, which was on Fairweather Street, one of these rambling old, you know, the classic WASP house in Cambridge. And in the foyer, they did apple dunking. And he and his wife sat there and they had the kids doing the apple dunking thing. But there was a big problem because over in Louisburg, is it Louisburg Square or Louisburg?
I think insiders say Louisburg.
Louisburg. Yeah, I think you
Louisburg
might be right.
Louisburg Square
myself,
in Boston, which of course is where John Kerry lived, where John Kerry's wife had the fire hydrant removed right. because it interfered with her parking. The maid in full uniform was giving out the Halloween
this is a
candy.
True story. It's great.
And I think one of the reporters got word of this, at which point John and Therese came racing home from wherever they were to take over the candy giving out duties.
Although, you know, for the record, I've always felt that's one of the harshest and most unfair moments in any politician's life. I mean, I'm reaching out in a sense to Charlie Baker and all the rest because you. It's always a trap, the night of October 31st.
Always.
The Herald and the Globe are so out to get you. And the kind of the last victim, you know, for whom I don't exactly have. I mean, the last victim was, you know, was what's her name? Martha Coakley, you know, because she doesn't really have like a Hamish existence. So,
no.
You know, she kind of answers in a suit. You know, she's just come back from, you know, busting some Medicaid miscreants. And it's like, it's the worst picture imagined. She has her little, you know, it's like that stuffed dog on Scrubs.
But, yeah.
But I mean, she has a little dog that she pets. But she has,
she has two big dogs.
Yeah, but she has to act like she has this kind of, you know, normal home or something. I don't know. It's like, it's very bad. Bad optics, as they would
By
say.
By the way, if she or Charlie Baker, whoever, is elected governor, I hereby commit with Marjorie, we will go through your trash as well. No, just to show that it's not about William Weld.
Exactly.
That is
we'll
a true story.
Nonpartisan trash curating.
I really don't know why we did that, but we did do that.
I don't
that.
Know, but it was fun. And
I
love the fact
you.
That he had apple picking.
That's now, really impressive. That's
foyer.
Really impressive. Wow.
Now, Alex, you have thought a lot, and you communicated this to Chelsea, our leader here, about the Berwickians, for lack of a better expression. Don Berwick is running for governor. He's one of the three men, people in the debate I have tonight on NECN and WGBH radio.
Like to see those ratings.
thank you. You'll be watching. I'm sure you will.
Oh, wow.
What is your Berwickian problem? What is your problem?
I guess I should have written a column about this, but I haven't been paying any attention to governor's race whatsoever. But starting at like about 6 weeks ago, all my friends, I live in Newton, the world temple of precious BS. Mm-hmm. All my friends have saying, "Oh, you know, you really should write about Don Berwick. He's so interesting." And you know, so that's a huge negative indicator that Newton
that he's huge in Newton.
Newton's on board.
Newton's mobilized behind. And I want to say right now.
By the way, Steve Grossman's from Newton too. You have two of the three Democrats.
Newton, yeah, but I don't get me started on him because I'm not fair to him. But I mean,
okay,
I don't, yeah. I don't know Mr. Berwick, and it sounds
Dr.
like
Dr. Berwick.
He's indeed, as the Wall Street Journal, you can call him doctor because he's a man.
MD.
Who can heal you, and like Henry Kissinger, who can only kill you. Yeah. Thank you.
That's a huge thing with me.
Huge with me.
Huge.
Bizarre.
I'm a juris doctor. You're going to call me doctor?
I'm not. I mean, but I respect you, but I'm not going to call you doctor.
Write it for this week.
Because you can't save my life.
What was your point?
Well, my point is that all my right-thinking friends think that he has all these great ideas, and then finally in the Globe, I mean, I've been hiding in New Hampshire for months, and the Globe publishes this huge Michael Levinson piece. It's really kind of interesting, and it calls him the candidate of ideas. And the minute I see that headline, I go like, just hang it up. Just don't even show up for the election. I mean, because he is the Adlai Stevenson in this race. And I mean, I will
Adlai Stevenson, who ran against Dwight Eisenhower
in 1952 and 1956. And even though I'm occupying a lot of airtime, I'm only leading towards saying one thing, which is one of the most famous sentences ever uttered in American politics was uttered by Adlai Stevenson.
My favorite quote in American political history.
Yeah, and you can learn a lot from this quote. Okay, I will. And I'll provide false context that I'm just simply making up. But I think around the time of the 1952 Democratic Convention, Stevenson had fanatically positive support. He was from Illinois. He was sort of an intellectual. And this woman comes up to Adlai Stevenson, Senator Adlai Stevenson, and says, Senator, I'm so happy you're going to be the Democratic candidate for the presidency. Every thinking American is going to support you. And Stevenson is very sharp, and he waits the beat, of course, and he looks at her back and says, "Ma'am, I'm really worried that every thinking American is going to support me."
No, actually, that isn't the punchline. The punchline is far better. He pauses, and then he says, "Sadly, madam, I need a majority," which is actually
a much better line.
Which is a far better line, is it not?
Yes. So, in any case, defer to your better knowledge. I agree, but that's Berwick in a nutshell. That's the whole point. Every thinking resident of the Commonwealth is going to vote for Berwick. I mean, the numbers are just going to be terrifying.
Are you at all? I assume the answer to this is no, but we have been railing against either people who aren't voting or people who don't know what's going on. You self-admitted, for lack of a better expression, that you're really not following this thing. Do you even know who the candidates are for most of these offices?
I do. No? And by the way, I made a decision driving down today from New Hampshire. I decided I'm going to vote for Donald Berwick.
You are?
And
why is that? Because
I'm meeting Mudder and him on public radio, so I thought I would give him my vote.
And why do you think you're so disinterested?
Well, no. I've heard you guys talking about that. I'm going to vote I care who the governor is.
Yeah, you do. Okay.
I'm going to vote in both races. I do know who the candidates are. Blah, blah. But I'm totally, this is the wrong place. I'm just totally in the tank to Baker and have been for decades, and I'm going
to
vote for
Why
him.
Why are you in the tank to Baker?
Actually, for a lot of different reasons. We knew him. He used to feed us stories at the Globe when he worked at the Pioneer Institute for this guy who's probably no longer. I don't know. He's an affable guy. I'm not going to do PR for him. And
Not doing PR.
He can take
you're
out
saying
a paid ad. I mean, I think he's a straight fellow. I don't think Martha Coakley is an unstraight lady, but I'm in the tank to him. So there you have it.
There we do have it.
Yeah. So are we going to talk about this Norwegian fixation of yours? We have time for that, I hope.
A couple of minutes, yeah.
Okay, yeah, because I'm really into this.
Of course, we got to get to the explainer.
Well, yeah,
that's
going to
take like 9 minutes.
We do, because you apparently have married a Norwegian. I mean, I wasn't sure if you wanted to laud the
He wrote about it. What do you mean, apparently?
Yeah, that was a long time ago.
That
could be anybody at this point.
The talents of your wife, or if it's about the fact that everybody loves Norway because it's a welfare state.
No, I wanted to
Scandinavian countries in general,
I wanted to highlight this excellent contrarian Slate opinion piece.
It's a great piece, actually.
It is a great piece, which is just stop boring the pants off us by comparing us to these, tiny, utterly ethnically homogeneous Nordic countries. Like Finland has great Wi-Fi. Okay, I'm really happy for Finland. You know, Sweden, everybody's on welfare and making more than anybody in this room. Okay, I'm really happy for the people in Sweden. Norway has North Sea oil. So like it's like Alaska. Everybody's rich. Nobody has to work. And of course, all their children are, in fact, quite literally above average. You know, they score way over any crazy metric that the loons at the UN can dream up.
Yeah.
You know, they're better educated. And they're for peace. I mean, can you imagine? It's like incredible. It's just, anyway, you got to read the Slate piece. It really kind of got me going because we have nothing in common with these absolutely tiny Aryan countries that, you know, where everybody gets a 96 on the world math quiz. It's like Singapore, to be blunt. There's another country we're practically always compared to. I mean, I've been to Singapore. It's like it's 100,000 pushy Chinese mothers.
Can you tell me one thing that you embrace that a majority of the population also embraces? I mean, that's one of the reasons you have a problem with this, is because everybody likes – I mean, everybody in Newton likes Donald Berwick, so you can't like Donald Berwick, at least according to you. Everybody admires the what are they called? The Nordic countries.
Do you really? Have you really thought this through?
I haven't thought about it at all.
Do you think someone who kills 120 people and then goes to live in a luxury hotel?
Wait, the one guy you're talking about?
Yeah, you admire that country?
I don't admire the criminal justice system, at least how they deal with that guy. Was the mass murderer who went to that island, Marjorie. The guy who killed all the kids.
It's unbelievable.
Yeah, it is unbelievable.
He's living better than like... You know, 46% of the Commonwealth.
So wait a second. Does that mean you should condemn the whole country? Because
why not?
Okay, fine.
Okay, exactly.
Yeah.
Okay.
They do some good lines in this piece. You're right. My favorite line is when they talk about the Nordic supremacy when it comes to tasteful turtleneck sweaters. I mean, that is really fantastic.
And burnished pine furniture.
Exactly.
Lest we
from
forget.
The finest Norwegian.
Yeah, they take care of people cradle to grave. I know it's a horrible thing. Now, Alex, before you go, and believe me, you're
he'd
going
have
soon.
Here, by the way,
this is the explainer thing for those who are new to the show or relatively new to the show or don't listen when Alex is on. He ends every segment with the explainer. What that is he takes something that's in the news or sort of in the news and that most people don't understand, and in 45 seconds or less, that's the key, 45 seconds or less, he explains it. Now, the topic, I believe, this week, from what I understand, is Scotland is seeking independence from the UK. Is that correct?
That is. I mean, who came up with this topic?
It's
beyond belief.
Okay,
right,
fine.
Okay.
Now, you were going to explain – I don't know what you're going to explain about it, but you're going to explain something about Scotland seeking independence from the UK. The vote, I think, is later this month.
September 18th.
Starting in – you have 5 seconds to think about it.
Okay.
Four, three. And
I'm avoiding myself – blanket immunity from factual error.
That's
here.
Fine. It's
okay,
fine.
Right.
Go ahead.
I just want to be
you
able to.
You always have it here. Go ahead.
Thank you. By the way, I respect that because I'm sorely in need of it.
Go ahead, take it away.
Okay,
go.
This is utterly ridiculous. But anyway, okay, so Scotland, you know, proud little Scotland, on September 18th is going to have apparently a binding referendum on whether or not to leave the United Kingdom, Great Britain. They they voluntarily joined the United Kingdom in the early 18th century. And so now it's very much in the balance as to whether they should secede and become their own charming little country where everyone wears plaid. The key here is that WGBH is sorely riven, like most of Scotland, over this, because Alan Cumming, who I believe is a presenter for Masterpiece Theatre, is doing ads advocating the so-called devolution of Scotland, that it become its own country. Whereas Dame Judi Dench, you can barely turn on public television these days without seeing Dame Judi Dench, and Mick Jagger, hilariously, are doing ads advocating Mick Jagger of all people. No, separately. They're being aired all over Scotland, urging the Scottish public to vote to remain within the United Kingdom. What are the actual issues? I really have no idea. It's obviously Great Britain will be a little more diminished, shall we say, without Scotland. Scotland also, like Norway, has North Sea oil, so they could probably cruise on that for 20 years. The only other thing is like a currency issue that I don't think would be of much interest to your listeners.
Speaking of diminished, I think we were just diminished by that explanation. it was excellent. I
enriched is what you're
which
groping
side are you
for.
On there, by the way? Are you for the pro-independence side, or are you staying with the Queen?
Well, I wasn't expecting that question, but now that you mention it, I want to keep the beautiful cross of St. Andrews on the British flag.
That's a wonderful point, actually. That is a really fine point.
It's one of the most pristine. I had never thought of this. One of the most pristine design elements on the British flag.
Doesn't the Queen vacation in Scotland every year? I mean, what
Balmoral's will happen? Balmoral's in Scotland.
Exactly. So what's the fate of Balmoral if it's no
longer... And the
longer...
Fringe Festival?
Exactly.
I mean, there's so much. And Ian Rankin, the world's greatest detective novelist, is he going to have to move?
I don't know.
because the tax consequences could be punishing.
I think this is very upsetting.
That was excellent.
It is.
No, really, you're too kind. It was excellent.
And I
think
you're right about the turtleneck sweaters in Norway as well.
Okay. All right. Well, we all wished Don Berwick the best. That's one thing we can agree on.
We absolutely do. He's a great guy.
Exactly. All my friends say so.
He's got a lot to recommend himself.
He's huge in Brookline as well.
He's got my vote.
Alex Beam, he joins us on Thursdays for Open Mic, and we're so glad he does. He's a columnist for the Boston Globe, and his latest book is American Crucifixion, The Murder of Joseph Smith and the Fate of the Mormon Church. Alex, thank you.
See you soon.
Up next, we're going to ask you about whom to vote for, who you vote for, and why. How many times have you voted for the candidate who will win instead of the candidate you believe in? That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. We're a little bit short on time, but we wanted to talk to you a little bit with the primary just days away about how people vote. And Alex was talking about Newton's love affair, he says, with Donald Berwick. You know, in so many elections, you're faced with a predicament. And this doesn't relate to him. It relates to any campaign. Are we going to vote for the candidate who we think will win because we want our party, assuming you belong to a party, to have the strongest candidate? Or do you vote for the candidate you believe in? On the national level, the best examples I could think of, Marjorie, was Ralph Nader. People voted for him in Florida, even though they knew he had no chance of winning in the race with Al Gore. And if you count up the votes and survey those people, had he not been in the race, Al Gore would have been president of the United States. But they chose principle over strategic voting. Ron Paul's another wonderful example. Locally, there have been candidates like Jill Stein, Bob Reich, Robert Reich running for governor. Visionaries who might have won your heart, but did they win your vote? So if you're in the voting booth, especially next Tuesday, what do you do if you believe your candidate is not going to pull this thing together, but he or she is the person who is closest to your heart and mind? Do you vote for that person, or do you say, I want to vote strategically to ensure that, I mean, we can say, look at the Republican race. Charlie Baker's beating Mark Fisher. I mean, the polls are public, 50, 60 points. If you totally believe in Mark Fisher's Tea Party agenda, do you vote for Mark Fisher, even though it's pretty unlikely he's going to win? Or do you vote for Charlie Baker so he's the strongest Republican coming out of the primary if you want Charlie, if you want a Republican to be the next governor? Our number is 877-301-8970. We don't have a lot of time, so you should get in. Do you vote strategically or do you vote as on principle?
Well, it depends.
What does that mean?
If the person that I really like, voting for that person is not going to mean – if it's a really close race and I know the person I really like has got no chance, and voting for that person would mean one less vote for the person that would be the lesser of two evils between the Democrat and the Republican, then I won't do it. But if it's just a vote for someone that I really, really like and it's not going to matter – then I'll do it.
I would never have voted for Ralph Nader,
no matter how much I liked him, because I knew the vote was really close between Gore and Bush.
And it would have taken away from Gore, who you'd prefer in that election over George Bush. That's your point. So you are, on occasion, you're a strategic voter.
I don't know if I could say I preferred Al Gore, but I suppose I viewed him as the person that I would – I'm not supposed to say who I voted for, am I?
Well, I think after the fact is
okay, after the fact.
Our number is 877-301. You don't have to say who you voted for, but – 301.
You told me I could say after the fact.
Well, it's too late. It's 877-301-8970. Tuesday is pretty close. Are you going to be a voter? Assuming you're a voter, because Bill Galvin, the Secretary of State, says only 20% of you are voting, which is just pitiful. Are you voting on principle? Are you voting strategically? Or maybe you're voting both. Let's start.
Okay, no. I said it. So what do you do?
I am exactly where you are. Okay. I'd like to think that I vote for the person who is closest to my worldview, but if I think that my second choice will suffer because of my act of principle, I wouldn't vote for somebody who I thought was horrible just to get, you know, have a better chance in a final, but if I thought that someone was quite good, even though not as good as the person nearest to my heart, then I would probably vote for that second person if I felt it was going to help him or her win an election.
So in this race, because Berwick is way behind and Grossman is not that far behind, but he's significantly behind.
Well, in some polls, yeah.
You could vote for Berwick and not worry about the outcome.
You could, unless you believe when Steve Grossman, as he said to us when he was here yesterday, that he's closing. In one poll, your former employer had him only 12 points behind.
12 points is a lot.
Well, I hear you. Let's start in Medfield, where Cam is on the phone. Cam, you're next on Boston Public Radio. Hey there.
Hi. I'm here, and I think you're folks should vote strategically, not sincerely, as political science would say. You've got to vote based upon your preferred policy outcome. There's all sorts of game theoretic models that game this out, and eggheads have looked at it very clearly. You vote strategically. Now, the folks on the sincere side will say, well, if everybody would vote sincerely, then you would get your perfect outcome. But the individual doesn't make the vote decision for everyone. I vote based upon my decision, not what everybody else does.
So I love your term. Is the terminology yours? You said you got it from a publication, strategically or sincerely.
I have to admit, I'm a political science professor.
Oh, you are?
I studied this stuff.
Well, I have to tell you, the terminology is beautiful, and you explained it far better than I can. Thank you. No, you did. Thank you very much for the call. Isn't that great? Strategically or sincerely? Isn't that really?
Yeah.
That's pretty perfect.
Sarah May in Cambridge. What do you think, Sarah?
Hey, Sarah May. How are you?
Hi, Jim. Hi, Marjorie.
Hi.
Hey there. I'm for Berwick. I haven't been so excited about a gubernatorial candidate that I didn't know from Adam and that I think is the real thing. He thinks strategically. He doesn't look at issues individually. He looks at how everything fits together. I think he'll be a terrific governor. I can just picture a debate between Berwick, the doctor, and Baker, the insurance guy. I think it would be absolutely wonderful.
Now, Sarah May, as somebody who I'm guessing, and I happen to know you, my guess is that more often than not, you choose a Democrat in a final. Is that a safe assumption?
Not always, but most of the time.
Okay, so if you were to be convinced that as much as you admire Donald Berwick, that your vote for Berwick, it's all speculative, but you convince that your vote for Berwick is going to deprive the second best candidate of winning the nomination if you're convinced that Berwick can't win it, do you still vote for Donald Berwick because he's the one who's closest to your heart in politics?
Well, I've been scolded by the son of mine who lives in Massachusetts, mm-hmm. who was for one of the other candidates, and says that a vote for Berwick will take away from this other candidate. And I'm sorry, my heart is with Berwick. He is rational. He thinks long term. He looks at the whole set of issues, and he's got administrative experience that we haven't had in the corner office. Even much as I love Deval Patrick, Berwick has extensive experience. The president picked him to head Medicare and Medicaid for a year and a half until the Republicans wouldn't approve his nomination. Yeah. This guy is for real.
We got it. And you answered the question perfectly. Sarah May, thank you so much for the call.
Sarah May should be doing an ad for Dr. Berwick.
No, but I mean, also she's one, and there are a lot of people like her who believe that you vote for the person who most reflects your worldview. I admire that.
Let's go to, I think it's Marin from Somerville. Did I get that right, Marin?
Morning, yes.
Hi there.
Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Well, thank you very much for making it. Yep.
I was just calling in to say, maybe it's different in a primary, but in a general election, I very much do not believe in voting strategically because that basically guarantees that only the most middle of the road candidates will ever get elected. Even a losing vote can send a signal that people are interested in a candidate, I think.
Did you say – I was hard to hear you a little bit. Do you say signaling
a vote? I'm terribly sorry.
Even
a losing vote can signal interest in a candidate.
Yep.
And I think help future candidates read the political situation a little better.
So you're saying that by voting for someone who is likely, whoever he or she is, to come not be a winner, you're voting for his or her agenda, so you're sending a message that you hope will be either embraced in the future or that election cycle. Is that where you're going?
Precisely. Plus, I think we need more diversity in our political landscape anyway.
Got it. Hey, Marm, thank you very much for the call. You know, strategic voting, the most extreme example that's totally different from what we're talking about, Amanda pulled together something. I'd forgotten about this. There was a lot of screaming after the Mississippi Senate primary, U.S. Senate primary. Do you know that's an open primary where anybody, any party can vote? And the allegation was made by the GOP chair, this guy Bill Armistead, and I believe it was borne out, is that a ton of Democrats were voting in the Republican primary in the hopes that in a close election they could nominate the weaker Republican. to run against the Democrat. That's an aberrational situation and can only happen because there's an open primary. We should say, by the way, if it wasn't clear, because we're excoriating people who are thinking of not voting on Tuesday, if you're an unenrolled person, and that's the majority of voters, I think it's 53% in the state, you can vote in either primary. If you want to vote in the Republican primary, you can do it. You want to vote in the Democratic primary, you can do that. So that is not an excuse for sitting home.
Let's. Do we have time for one
more?
No,
we don't, sadly.
We don't have time. I'm sorry. We're out of time. Oh, well, that's the way it goes.
That is.
Yes.
Sorry.
Thank you for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tune in tomorrow. We have Open Mic with Emily Rooney. She is back with a fresh and fun list. And the MFA's director, Malcolm Rogers, will be here. He's been there for 20 years.
Can't wait to talk to him.
He's leading, so I can't wait to talk to him either. Our show is a production of WGBH, Boston Public Radio. Our production team, Chelsea Mers, Will Roslip, Amanda McGowan. Our engineer is Alan Mattis. I am Marjorie Egan. Tell us about your debates, Jim.
Well, before I do that, I want to say, speaking of Malcolm Rogers, who we'll have tomorrow, Jared Bowen on TV did a brilliant interview with Rogers, which you should Google and find as well. I am doing a debate tonight, the final debate of the three Democrats running for governor, 6 o'clock on an ECN simulcast on WGBH radio if you cannot get to a television.
You know what?
What?
You're a great moderator,
well,
Jim.
That's nice.
I got
to say that.
You know, Tim Russert, no longer here, but you
do
a great job. You're
good.
You're
a kind soul.
You're very good. I'm Marjorie Egan.
I'm Jim Browdy.
See you later. Thanks for listening.